A match that, if I win, will thrust me into the kind of spotlight that makes me ill to imagine. The ministry would like to remind Antigone Sir Ayla of the intensely public nature. Vows to serve the state. I look from Kor as Chryssa strains to hold him back, to Duck, unconscious as the medic removes his armor, to Power, watching with a satisfied smile. Then I look to the cave mouth where Darius waits for me, wrist lifted to his mouth to summon his storm scourge as his family and friends watch from the gold stands. And then all those things fade away, and all that is left is a single thought. Like hell am I throwing this match. I look up at Lee and nod. Whatever he's searching my eyes for, he seems to find. His hands drop from my shoulders, and I turn from him to walk toward the cave mouth. Annie, says a different voice. I stop again. Goran's hand has taken my shoulder. I look back at him. Remember what the ministry wrote you about, Goran says. He towers over me, broad-shouldered in his uniform, the figure that for years I've associated with the sour taste of my own inadequacy. For a moment, I feel a clarity that's piercing and bright, the kind I usually only feel with Ayla. Except this time, I find it alone. Crystallized within it is an anger I had forgotten I possessed. I turn my back on him without a word.
Lee. There is a moment when it happens, usually somewhere between summoning and launch, where Annie transforms from the person she is on the ground to the one she becomes in the air. Where the hesitation vanishes, the awkwardness falls away, and suddenly she's free. Unleashed. As many times as I've seen it happen, today I am struck by it as if it were the first time. As she and Darius rise into the air to take their positions, I can practically feel the surge of energy rising. Duck is stirring, groaning. The coolant that Master Welsey applies is beginning to do its work. Keeping my eyes on Annie's copper-toned Aurelian, I rise from their sides to go and stand beside Goran. Looks like it really did the trick, I tell him. His eyes remained fixed on the dragons above us, and he responds with irritation. I'm sorry. Whatever you just said to her. The bell rings. Darius and his iron grey storm scourge charge forward, while Annie and Ayla turn upward and begin to rise. Racing the pull of gravity, charging full speed into the cloudless sky, so fast, so sure, so beautiful that the hair on the back of my neck stands on end. The others might not see the difference, but I do. Annie flies like something out of the old order. She always has. The instincts that were trained for me by a childhood of watching dragons with their riders are, for her, instincts she was simply born with. After all, the riders of the new regime have no role models of mature riders. We do not have the luxury of being trained by our dragon-riding fathers, whose own training came from their fathers before them. Whatever guidance my father could have given me died with him. But Annie has never needed guidance at all. Darius realizes what's happening a split second later and urges his storm scourge up after her to regain the vertical distance, but she's already taken the lead, and in any case, Ayla is faster and lighter than Myra. There are whistles of delight around us as the other riders realize what Annie's doing. Height is always an advantage. Gravity is a weapon. But the most obvious way to use it, descending from on high with double the speed of your opponent, is the kind of maneuver very few riders have the skill to pull off. I feel a smile breaking my face. Goran is silent, his brows scrunched up as he stares upward into the sun. The gap widens as they rise. Slowly, as they become mere points of darkness against the sky, each begins to slow. And then Annie, a mere pinprick above us, stalls. For a moment, everything is still. She dives. Darius, hovering below her, wavers and stalls, preparing for her attack. There are screams around us, from the other riders, from the stands. Ayla's wings are beating at full force, maximizing her speed in free fall. She is hurtling toward Darius. And then, when they are in range, it happens in a blurring instant. Darius fires, she swerves, it misses, and she fires into an opening that only she can see. And then she's hurtling past him, toward the eyrie, and Darius is following behind. The front of his armor is blackened with a kill shot. Annie won her match in a little under 2 minutes. The bell is ringing as Ayla skids and clatters onto the eyrie edge. Annie slices the straps, fixing her boots in their stirrups, and leaps off. She takes off her helmet. Her red-tinged hair, the same color as Ayla's scales, glints in the sunlight, streaked and flattened with sweat. Her expression is defiant, almost angry. But then at the sound of the screaming and cheering, it changes. Slowly, haltingly, as she makes sense of it, she begins to smile. Darius dismounts laboriously. Annie goes to him and offers her hand. She seems surprised when he shakes it.
"Antigone Sir Ayla, the final member of the Fourth Order," the announcer tells the crowd.
I have moved toward her, pulled by the magnetism of her beaming smile. As I congratulate her and our eyes meet, I see her smile change and briefly soften, as if she recognizes in a fleeting moment the same thing I do. The tournaments aren't over, the bracket is narrowing. She and I are, after today's results, set on an increasingly likely collision course. But that's still a long way off and possibly not a future at all. The way the penalties from today add up, the next tournament, in a month, will place me against Kor, Annie will face Power. And then, still one more tournament to determine first rider. Together, the four of us mount the stairs for the concluding ceremony. Duck has been taken to the palace infirmary. Kor is reasonably calmed, but nevertheless, I take care to walk between him and Power. Annie's breath is still heaving, the sweat on her face undried. It's not until we enter the palace box that I feel the familiarity of it roll over me in a wave I'd forgotten to steel myself against. I have memories of this place. Atreus is seated on the dais that once held the seats of the three triarchs who ruled together before the revolution. Arcturus Aurelian, Kit Skyfish, and my uncle Crethon Stormscourge. Now there's only the First Protector. Around him, in the seats that were once reserved for the most powerful members of the Dragonborn families, now sit the members of his council and other officials of the new regime. The jewels and sumptuous gowns that I remember have been replaced by the simple uniforms of government functionaries. Instead of the triarchy's infinite loop of the circling dragons of the three families, the red banners rippling above us bear the revolution's dragon, wings spread, breathing the four circlets of fire representing the four classes of the new regime. There's an aisle down the length of the box, from the stairs we've mounted to the dais, where Atreus waits. The last time I was in this place, I watched my father walk down it. Beside me, Annie inhales the faintest breath. She looks from me to the faces of the adults turned toward us. The same ones who revealed themselves this morning to doubt her fitness for this moment. Annie's letter was unsigned, but the Minister of Propaganda, Miranda Hayne, is standing in this audience, 3 feet away from Atreus, and her eyes are on Annie. There's no time to exchange more than a glance, so all I can do is give Annie a smile and a nod forward as we begin our walk down the aisle. Annie's steps are paced with mine, her gaze, like mine, set straight ahead. I can practically hear her holding her breath as she imitates me. This is how you do it. This is how you own a victory. My father's rugged smile, his tired but triumphant gait, his sparking eye catching his older brother's with a muted shrug as he knelt to accept his laurel, return to me as I walk. The last tournament I saw him in, I was 7 years old. A melee against the Aurelians. A bit of spring entertainment that was their calm before the storm in a year of growing unrest. Unrest that would become a revolution Now, 10 years later, I bend a knee before the man who betrayed my father and my people. He places the laurel of the Fourth Order on my brow. Beside me, Annie takes a knee to accept her own laurel in turn. In a concluding speech, Atreus refers to the tournaments ahead that will move us one step closer to the title of First Rider of Callipolis, and after that, to the naming of Atreus's successor. One step closer to solidifying the institutions of a revolutionary regime that replaces the one held by my family for centuries. The revolutionary regime that struggles to undo their centuries' worth of wrongs. Annie stands beside me, her expression frozen, her breathing light and rapid, as these words wash over us. I marvel, with the part of my mind not lost in memories of another life, at the fact that this girl, who can stare down a dragon twice Ayla's size, can be stricken by the sight of a few dozen functionaries' scrutinizing faces. My father's voice returns to me from another lifetime. "It will come to you naturally, Leo. We were born to rule." No. That world is gone now, and I'm done with it. And then, with a surging sorrow that I thought I had outgrown, "Forgive me, Father."
Annie. Rock is waiting for me at the foot of the stairs, blocking the exit with his great frame. And he's beaming. It is not an expression I'd expect from someone who just lost his match.
"They're here," he says.
His Highland accent has thickened inexplicably. My stomach flips. Who?
"That family. From your village. Got here just before your match started. They're sitting next to my folks. You didn't tell me you had Highlanders coming."
He seizes my arm, and I follow him into the bronze section, pushing through the crowds of people who part with excited congratulations as we pass. I register, only in afterthought, that the congratulations are directed at me. And then I see them. A burly, greying man, a stout woman, with her hair wrapped under a faded scarf, and a line of children beside them who share their parents' sunburned faces and yellow hair. They're older and taller, and also fatter. Their bodies full and well-fed, no more jutting bones or too taut skin.
"Annie," Mr. Mackey croaks, with the Highland accent that still brings me warmth, though it faded from my own speech long ago.
Mrs. Mackey says, "Annie, darling, you did wonderfully. We're so proud."
"Thank you," I start to say. But the words don't get all the way out because I've choked on them.
And then Mr. Mackey, whom I haven't seen since I was 6, who last knew me as a freshly orphaned child sleepless from nightmares of dragonfire, puts his arms around me the same way he did 10 years ago and says,
"That I live to see the day when Silas's daughter rode a dragon. We've never been prouder of anything, Annie."
It's not a long reunion, but every minute of it feels like water on parched earth. They tell me how Holbin has changed since I last saw it. The houses rebuilt, new herds raised, wool sold to the city textile houses as a part of Atreus's push to grow trade and alleviate Callipolis's dependence on subsistence farming. At first, the Holbiners had been nervous of these innovations. But now, well-fed even in winter, their memories of the old famines long faded, and their children attending sporadic schooling down in Thornham, Holbin has more to hope for and little left to fear.
"Except dragons," Mackey jokes, and then hastens to add, "But that's just people being backward. They'll see they've nothing to fear with you riding one, Annie, one day."
The Mackey's oldest son, whose letter reached me a week ago, hands me a bouquet of wildflowers that smell like home. When I compliment his writing, a childish script, poorly spelled and not punctuated at all,
but for all that, something I beheld as a miracle. He blushes. I remember him as a toddler. He's 13 now. Too soon, it's time to bid them farewell. They mean to drive back today alongside Rock's family, who offer to have them stay the night with them in their home in the near Highlands at Thornham on their way back to Holborn. I weave toward the palace entrance through a lingering crowd whose congratulations I receive with dazed gratitude in passing. Thumped on the shoulder, bronze and iron wristbands flashing on wrists as craftsmen and day laborers beam at me and usher me through their midst, calling out in the hard vowels of the urban accents. I'm shorter than most of them by a head. It's the Highland Rider! Antigone Sir Ayla! How's that for a win? Told you, Jeff. Told you the girl riders could hold their own. You flew very well. I stop at the sound of the last voice, low and toned with an accent that sounds faintly foreign, cutting through the murmur of the crowd easily. A young woman's voice. When I turn to look, I see that she's barely older than me, perhaps Chris's age. Long, dark hair frames a narrow face and piercing grey eyes above a dark, full-length cloak. Thank you, I say. You are Antigone? Yes. A worthy name. Uncommon. Are you from a patrician family? I shake my head, surprised that she doesn't know. Holborn, I say. The Highlands. A victor's laurel on my forehead, Highland wildflowers in my arms. The words fill me with pride. The girl's eyes flash in surprise. Extraordinary, she says. And what about the other rider, the other talented one? What is his name? The other talented one. I don't need to ask whom she means. Though I feel it would be inappropriate not to. On the White Aurelian. The traditional description of Palor's colour mutation, silver where most Aurelians are shades of amber and gold. Yes. Lee Sir Palor. Lee, the girl repeats thoughtfully. Where is he from? She is studying me intently. My pulse accelerates, and it is suddenly difficult to provide the needed answer. Cheapside, I tell her. A slum orphan. The Guardian's neighborhoods of origin is publicly available information. I cannot shake the impression, as I say it, that I am telling this girl something she already knows, that what she's really interested in is my face as I say it. But that makes no sense. She must be from Deimos. That's why she's asking these questions any Kallipolin would know. Although she is pale, almost as pale as a Kallipolin Highlander. Indeed, the girl says, her eyes still traveling my face. Well, congratulations again, Antigone. And then she turns and walks away, pulling her hood over her head as she does. Below the hem of her cloak, I can make out riding boots. But then I look at the boots more closely. I take in the leather reinforced to resist heat, shafts for coolant, slits for boot knives, and slots for straps to tie into stirrups. Those aren't just riding boots. They're dragon riding boots. I am still puzzling over her footwear as I re-enter the palace and return to the Guardian's cloister, whose disjointed collection of repurposed servants' quarters and former dragon lord's studies surround a small central courtyard in a wing of the outer palace. This afternoon, the cloister is deserted. The rest of the Guardians are out in the city with their friends and families, celebrating. Except, of course, Lee. There you are, he says. He's washed, put on his ground uniform, and taken off his laurel. But he's still flushed with triumph, his face lit by a half-smile that makes him seem younger, less guarded, less tired. The face of someone who's glimpsed the future and found it bright. "I was just about to check on Duck in the infirmary," he says. "Want to come?"
Duck? How could I have forgotten?
"Yes, let me change first." In the empty girls' dorm, I pause before entering the washroom. Apart from the guardian's banner, an entwined circlet of silver and gold hanging above the doorway, the room is austere. But the guardian's prescription from possessions doesn't prevent us from decorating our spaces in small ways. Krissa covers the wall of her desk with her drawings and bits of shells and sea glass from her hometown on the coast. Some of the others tack up assignments they're trying to memorize or bits of their favorite dragon tongue poetry. I go to my bare desk and place the wildflowers in my drinking glass. Then I remove the laurel from my brow and hook it on the wall. I pull the ministry's letter from my pocket and read it again. "The ministry would like to remind Antigone Sir Ayla of the intensely public nature of the obligations of riders of the Fourth Order." Maybe I read it wrong from the start. Maybe it's a challenge. And even if it's not, I'm going to tell myself it is. Let everything that intimidates me about the Fourth Order be another test, another training hurdle, another set of skills to master. Even if I don't make First Rider, even if I'm never chosen for Protector, I'll serve the state better by bettering myself, one step at a time. I can make history one step at a time. I tack the ministry's note to my wall too.
Chapter 3. First Sighting. He and the girl were in an unofficial alliance. He didn't think of it as friendship, because it mostly consisted of sitting near her at meals, in the yard, in class, and, at first, not talking. After the episode with the knife, he'd gained a reputation for being deranged and dangerous, and that reputation was useful. People left him alone, and when he was in her vicinity, they left the girl alone too. He didn't really consider why he was doing this, nor did he realize that it helped him. She was a foothold out of the months of sleepwalking. Their silence turned into conversations. Sometimes she would repeat what he said, slightly differently, as if his pronunciation bothered her. At first, he was terrified that she'd realized what the accent meant, that he was someone other people wanted dead. But she never seemed suspicious, not even when he imitated her corrections, repeating them under his breath until he could say them right. When teachers called on him in class, he began to answer. The girl remained silent. "You can read Kalish pretty well, right?" he finally asked. They were in the schoolyard. He handed her what he had learned, recently, was called a newspaper. It was an invention of the new regime. "Read this to me." By then he'd learned a few things about the girl. That she taught herself to read without a teacher, because no one in her village had been literate, and that she came from the far highlands, from a village that had been in his father's landholdings. He felt good about this. It justified his looking after her, because she belonged to him. The girl took the newspaper and said, "Which part?" He could think of no way to request news about the three families that wouldn't seem suspicious, and instead he just said, "Everything." So the girl read to him, that newspaper and others too as he found them. It was a time of great change on their island, and they couldn't help being swept up in what they read. The boy listened raptly to all news of the First Protector, the man who had saved him, and he couldn't help being infected by how excited the girl was about it all, even the things neither of them fully understood. The most important event that they struggled to understand was a referendum that Atreus's post-revolutionary People's Assembly held concerning 32 dragon eggs that had survived the Red Month. Should the eggs be destroyed? Should Kallipolis do as neighboring Deimos had done centuries before and become dragonless and democratic? Or, if their dragons were hatched and Kallipolis remained an airborne nation, how would they decide which children would be offered to the dragon hatchlings for their choosing? The first protector proposed a merit-based dragon rider selection process. Delegates from the coast supported this, arguing that air power was necessary to the island's military defense. But delegates from the inner countryside and the city's poorer districts argued that dragons had only ever been used to oppress and control. Still others argued that this third way would become something new, unknown since the beginning of dragon riding on the Medean. Guardians would be the dawn of a new era, of dragons in the service of justice. The boy and girl shuttled back and forth through these arguments, debating them in echoes of what they read. The girl tended to oppose keeping dragons. The boy tended to favor them. But each was not without their wavering moments. "I suppose it would be different if the people riding dragons were good," the girl allowed. The boy's concern, meanwhile, was one he didn't confide. Of course the dragons ought to be kept, he thought. But what would it mean to have them ridden by commoners? The idea unsettled him deeply. Atreus's proposal passed, narrowly. The guardian program became something their teachers talked about in class, as well as something they read of in newspapers. Its purpose served, Atreus dissolved the People's Assembly. He did not call it again. Instead, the newspapers began to tell of a test that would be administered to all, giving the lowest a chance to rise, the highest to prove their worth, and the children of all an opportunity to test into the dragon's choosing ceremony that had, historically, been reserved for the sons of the three families alone. Finally, the article the boy had been hoping for came. It said that not all members of the three families had been accounted for during the Red Month. Some of the Dragonborn were missing. The article suggested that they had survived, that, their identities hidden, they had escaped to New Pythos and been given refuge. Though the boy's name was not on the list of missing Dragonborn, others he remembered were. The boy told the girl, "I have to leave."
"The basement?"
"The orphanage." The girl looked up at him. They were doing dishes over a basin of nearly frozen water, their fingers raw and shaking from cold. The girl had by now started doing her chores alongside him. She was teaching him how to work more efficiently, so he would be punished less often.
"Don't bother washing the backs of those plates. They're not the dirty part." "But why would you want to leave the orphanage? There's food here."
"Yeah, but everyone here are just peasants." The girl's brow furrowed. The boy turned his plate over and began to scrub its other side. He hesitated, and then confided what the news article had given him confidence to finally share with her.
"The point is, I've got people who are probably waiting for me."
"In the city?"
"No, somewhere else. Another island."
"Can I come with you?"
"Sure," he said. "Maybe you could be my maidservant or something."
"I don't know how to be a maidservant."
The boy considered. He didn't know how to be a maidservant either.
"I think they just wash things," he said. "You're really good at that. Want to plan the trip with me?"
It was winter, so they agreed that they mustn't go now. Spring, maybe, or summer. And then there was the question of provisions and a backpack, and what you put in the backpack. Sometimes they wrote lists of things they'd need, which was exciting. Sometimes they actually acquired items on the list, which was even better. They began to build a stockpile in an unused closet on the third floor, and sometimes they would go there and make inventories, or just sit next to the pile of goods and read newspapers together.
Lee. It's a relief to resume our usual routine after the weekend of the tournament. An early breakfast in the cloister, bread and cheese tucked in my satchel for lunch later. Then Cor and I head out of the palace for a round session down in the manufacturing district. Cor nods at the fourth pair of silver dragon's wings, pinned on the shoulder of our uniforms, signifying rank of the Fourth Order. Dapper, aren't they? Yeah, I say we keep them. Kor lets out a bark of laughter. I wonder if he, like me, is strategically avoiding the thought that in a month we'll be back in the arena, facing each other. Early in the morning, this late in spring, the city is in full form. We leave the palace through the gardens, opened to the public since the revolution, and overlooked by Pytho's Keep and the Janiculum Hill, the patrician neighborhood on the palace side of the river. Crossing the bridge over the Fir, Kor takes us along his favorite routes through his native high market, quieter than the main thoroughfares where bustling shopkeepers hawk their wares to wealthier customers from across the river. But even on the quiet streets, guardian uniforms attract attention. This soon after the public tournament, a few people actually point. A fruitmonger stops us to press cut melon into Kor's hands, bobbing his head in a half bow. It's an urban courtesy left over from Aurelian rule over the city, and we've been taught to ignore it. For the two guardians as a thank you for their service to the city. Kor thanks him for the melon, grinning lopsidedly. Outside the palace, in his home neighborhood, the hard high market vowels return to Kor's speech. He begins to gnaw his slice as we continue walking. We're not supposed to accept that kind of thing, I tell him. Do you want your half or not? I'm happy to eat it if you're too noble. I wrest my melon from him. Thanks to regular rounds with the Ministry of Propaganda, I'm primed to notice the posters changing as we pass through the city. In Highmarket, with its high concentration of skilled labourers, the posters tacked on walls laud the virtues of citizens who've tested bronze. Bronze is born of strength and skill. But as we pass into the poorer neighbourhoods, Southside and the manufacturing district, where unskilled labourers live and work, the posters change. Iron is the strength of the city, they read. And in addition to praising the virtues of iron class, they praise the metals test itself and the wisdom of Atreus for instituting it. Anyone can become gold, these posters read. School for everyone makes opportunity for all. Laying it on a little thick, don't you think? Kor mutters. The posters aren't wrong, I point out. I saw enough during my years at Alban's orphanage to mark the changes that have been made in the poorer neighbourhoods over the years since the revolution. New housing has been erected. Roads are now cobbled. Schools have been built in neighbourhoods where literacy had been unheard of. For the most part, the people we pass seem well-fed, if a little poorly dressed, and they walk with the purposeful stride of the employed. The posters might be heavy-handed, but they're heavy-handed about changes that are real. Kor tusks. All the same, he says. You'll notice that they don't bother putting up this stuff in Scholar's Row or the Janiculum. Scholar's Row is the other gold-heavy neighbourhood besides the Janiculum. It contains the Lyceum, Atreus's university for the gold students, as well as the War College for the Silvers. When the Guardians aren't on round sessions as a part of our government training, we split our classes between the two academies in Scholar's Row. Kor's never stopped noticing its differences from the poorer neighbourhoods, including the one he's from. My answer, that his home neighbourhood is still better off than it used to be, has never been enough for him. I stop at the door of a hulking warehouse, off a dusty windowless street, its sign faded over an oversized door. This is it. Fullerton's is one of the city's most successful new textile houses, on our round schedule to tour today before class. Rounds have a way of filling Kor's and my daylight hours where homework would best be done, leaving classes as something we're perpetually treading water to keep up with, but that's not the kind of thing you complain about. Heavy rounds are a sign of favour, and anyway, they're the real education. They're the part of the day you see what the city actually does, instead of hearing about it. The Fullerton foreman is carefully dressed, closely shaven, and begins to sweat through his outer jacket as he gives us his tour. Afterward, we shadow him as he goes about his morning routine among the workers tending looms, bent over dyeing vats, filling stockrooms with shipments bound for Deimos and Basileia. Then Kor goes into his office to occupy him with additional questions, while I pull aside one of the class iron workers. In a lowered voice, I double-check the numbers the foreman gave us: wages, hours, breaks, days off. It's a system Cor and I devised years ago after we began to notice discrepancies. This is not technically part of our obligations on rounds, but it's become our common practice. The girl I've pulled aside twists her iron wristband the whole time I talk with her, stammering her responses, eyes not travelling higher than the guardian circlet emblazoned on the breast of my uniform, until I ask her where she's from. She gives me the answer I can already hear in her accent, Cheapside. I tell her I grew up there. She finally meets my eyes to answer, "I know." And then I'm able to get more out of her. How she's treated, if she has any complaints. She's close to my age, but the accompanying observations, that she's full-figured, pretty, wisps of brown hair escaping her scarf, I push away with discomfort. Power and Darius might enjoy the high of flirting with awestruck class irons, but their vulnerability makes me want to do anything but. I pretend I haven't noticed the flush growing along her neck as we speak. "Overall, how do you find your work?" She seems surprised by the question. "It's honest, and I'm glad I've got it." Sometimes with class irons, you can feel the resentment burning because of their test results, but most Cheapsiders are grateful for Atreus's programs. The manufacturing district, the public works programs, the quarries and the mines all provide wages, albeit low ones, for those who previously struggled to find work at all. Afterward, as Cor and I head back through the dusty streets to Scholar's Row for class, we compare the notes from the worker with those of the foreman. Her numbers matched his. "Did she report anything?" Cor asks. "Nothing unusual. Her feet hurt, her back hurts, but overall she's fine." Back on Scholar's Row, we enter the gate of the Porter's Lodge to the Lyceum. Coming from the barren, oversized proportions of the manufacturing district, full of grim-faced workers hurrying down dusty streets, the serene beauty of the Lyceum is disorienting, with its intricate stone courtyards and carefully tended greens full of laughing, carefree scholars. Gold students are encouraged to pursue government work after finishing their schooling, but not obligated. Many go on to careers in academia, the arts, in trade. Cor sees a few other guardians lounging under an oak and goes to join them. I head inside. We've got a spare half hour, enough time for me to finish up my reading for diplomacy in the empty classroom before it starts. I'm already walking into the lecture hall before I realize I've been hearing someone speaking inside it. Too late, I stop. A single person is in the room before me. Annie. Sitting in her usual seat, midway up the hall. She's staring at me, frozen. The room is silent now. Annie was projecting, I realize. Talking as if she were answering a question to the empty room. Her voice was raised louder than I've ever heard it in class. Practicing. Good. She's beet red. I back out of the room. "I'll see you in a bit," I say. "No, you can..." "I'll finish my reading in the library." A half hour later, I return to the lecture hall, where I take my seat beside Cor and Chrissa toward the front. Duck, stiff with bandages and still only allowed out of the infirmary for class, has taken his usual seat beside Annie in the back corner. The rest of the class is filing in, a combination of guardians and Lyceum students, along with the occasional adult class Gold who's dropped by for the intellectual exercise. Gold students seated in the row below us twist around to congratulate me and Cor for our performances in the tournament, while Chrissa looks on, smirking. With anyone but Chrissa, being congratulated next to the person you bested in a match would be uncomfortable, but Chrissa's ability to laugh things off is legendary. After we're done fielding compliments from Gold girls, she leans over. "Enjoying yourselves?" "We're doing our civic duty," Cor says. We all rise as Professor Perkins enters. When we've resumed our seats, he asks for a volunteer to summarize our reading assignment. Fresh off finishing it in the Lyceum Library, I know better than to raise my hand. The reading was about New Pythos. It falls solidly into the category of discussions I don't volunteer to participate in. For the first time in my memory, Annie's is among the hands that go up. Perkins's eyes, clouded with age and accustomed to her region of the classroom being a dead zone for volunteers, passes right over it. Lee? My stomach lurches. I watch Annie's hand droop.
That was some fine flying at the tournament this weekend, Perkins adds,
his light brown wrinkles doubling with a smile. A few appreciative whoops go up around the room. Cor thumps me on the shoulder, and it startles a grin out of me that lasts a half second.
Thank you.
Then I look down at the reading, take a half breath, and steel myself. The article says, there's no way to prove the rumours about New Pythos having dragons aren't true, and suggests reassessing them as a threat. Perkins nods and provides the counter-argument.
But New Pythos has never been allowed access to dragons, and lacks the hot springs that make for fertile hatching grounds. How could the Ha'orelians have air power, Lee?
Ha'orelians, half-Orelians, are the dragonless branch of Aurelian House that colonized New Pythos generations ago. Palm sweating, I answer again.
Offshore egg stockpiles. The author suggests that the three families might have hidden eggs. The dragonborn who escaped to New Pythos could have taken that knowledge with them.
The dragonborn who escaped. I could practically recite the names of missing dragonborn in my sleep, and the ones I think of most often are my cousins, Ixion and Julia. Ixion was a little older than I, Julia closer to my age. After Palace Day, the bodies thought to be theirs were too disfigured to be conclusively identified.
Very good. Thank you, Lee.
Perkins turns to the class in general.
What do we make of this theory?
Rather tenuous,
says a girl with an accent of the liquid melody of the southern vassal islands.
An excuse for warmongering, says another boy,
patrician, judging by the fine cut of his tunic and the clipped tones of his palace standard accent.
More fodder for the people's paper.
There are chuckles around the room. The people's paper is the paper that circulates among the lower class metals, heavily regulated by the Ministry of Propaganda, and most golds don't deign to read it.
Perkins nods. Perhaps, he allows. But the real difficulty with such theories is that given our diplomatic situation with New Pythos, there is no way to prove them right or wrong. Callipolis and New Pythos have never recognized each other's sovereignty, and their only means of communication is through embassies of neutral third-party states. With such a lack of transparency, how can we know what they intend? Much less what they are accomplishing, shrouded by all that North Sea fog.
I leave class lost in memories. It's rare that I let my thoughts linger on New Pythos these days. The escape I used to plan so eagerly in my spare time with Annie. The distraction that was so welcome amid everything else. The plans that ended up coming to nothing.
Hey!
Present-day Annie has materialized in front of me in the middle of the Lyceum courtyard, Duck at her side. Cor and Chrissa are at mine. From Annie's purposeful expression, I half expect her to bring up our encounter before class. But instead, she jerks her chin sideways toward the Lyceum Club. I want to have lunch. The sounds of laughter come muted through the club's latticed windows. Neither of us has ever eaten there, though there's nothing preventing it. The only requirement for admission is a gold wristband. Duck swings round to look at her, but she isn't looking at anyone but me. I've stopped walking.
You won't like it.
Annie has stopped too, and her arms are folded.
We can go.
Other guardians go.
Certain other guardians go. The Lyceum Club has a reputation for being more welcoming to certain Lyceum students than others. In other words, the ones from patrician families, Lotus, Power, Darius, Alexa, and Max, who grew up on Janiculum Hill and like to meet up with their grammar school friends, dine there regularly. For my part, I've never been interested in observing how the new aristocracy of Callipolis entertains themselves. The patricians from the Janiculum were intimately involved in Atreus's revolution. Their betrayal of the Dragon Lord's key to its success. And now the metals test is something they benefit from. They tend, overwhelmingly, to test gold. I like the opportunities Atreus has created for the poor from neighborhoods like Cheapside. The opportunities he's made for the patricians of the Janiculum, I care less for.
I want to try it, Annie says.
Then try it without me. But that doesn't seem to be an option she's willing to consider. She looks furiously determined and at the same time frightened, as if, more than the club itself, her own initiative scares her most of all. It hooks me against all reason. I push away my foreboding.
Fine, I say.
Dark, Cor and Krissa are looking between us, mystified. Because, after all, why should I, Lee the slum rat, be the gatekeeper for this rite of passage Annie seems to have created for herself?
You coming?
I ask Krissa and Cor.
Got that thrill out of my system ages ago,
Krissa says, hoisting her bag higher on her shoulder.
Cloister for me. Cor?
Cor shifts, squinting at the club with apprehension.
Yeah, maybe some other time. I'll go,
Duck says to Annie. The three of us mount the steps of the Lyceum Club. In the foyer, I stare down the host whose job is to check wristbands. Though we've never met before, he seems to recognize me and lets us in without even glancing at my wrist. We enter a dark, wood-paneled dining room, full of arguing students, aging professors filling the room with pipe smoke, and all ages in between. Class golds of any age are welcome to dine in the club whenever they please, regardless of whether they're attending classes. The polished wooden tables are scattered with today's edition of the Gold Gazette, the preferred paper of the class golds because of its greater editorial freedom. It circulates only within palace and Lyceum walls.
Lee, how are you?
A gold student I know from Damian Philosophy calls my name from a table in the centre of the floor, where he sits with a few friends. Their meals are half finished, fluted glasses of summer wine nearly empty. They've turned and are smiling in my direction, beckoning.
Care to join us? We can pull up chairs.
I can almost feel Annie recoiling beside me. Sitting with barely known acquaintances seems to be more than she bargained for.
Thanks, Ian. Don't trouble yourselves. Good to see you all.
I return their smiles, clasp Ian on the arm, then lead Annie and Duck past them. As we cross the floor, I note the presence of other guardians in the room, easy to spot in their uniforms. Power and Darius, unsurprisingly, with a few girls from rhetoric class. More surprisingly, Rock at a private table with Lotus in a far corner. I lead us to an empty booth. Annie takes the seat with its back to two walls and scans the room as though she were on dragonback, surveying hostile terrain. Duck eases himself in after her, with the care of someone trying not to aggravate burns beneath his uniform.
Where's the serving counter?
Annie mutters. There isn't one.
So how?
Annie falls silent. A young woman has appeared at our table, wearing a variation on serving attire I haven't seen since before the revolution. Hers is the only iron wristband in sight.
May I take your orders, sirs and miss?
Duck looks at the server in fascination. Annie goes red, as she does whenever she interacts with servants. What's on the menu today? I ask. The serving girl tells us it all sounds better than anything I've had in years. I order, and then Duck, looking even more stunned by the choices she's listed, asks for the dish that incorporates bacon. Annie, who does not seem to have processed any of what we've said, mutters that she'd like the same as me, please.
I'll be back with your drinks in a moment.
We watch her walk away. Then Annie twitches.
What do you think her wages are?
Because I do rounds with the Labour Draft Board, I know exactly what her wages are. Decent. More than most class irons make in the textile houses, and loads better than mining. I'm beginning to acclimate enough to listen in on conversations around us, and the number of them happening in Dragon Tongue is startling. In most parts of the city, its triarchist associations mean that Kalish is preferred. But here, with so many patricians for whom Dragon Tongue is their native language, it's used freely. Heard colloquially outside language class, it sounds like a parody of the old life.
It's not that I'm opposed to censoring per se, but wouldn't you agree that he goes too far?
I'd take a Damian Red over a Kalish any day, no question.
Our food arrives. We've always been well fed in the cloister, and coming from Albans, I've never thought to question its quality, but this is something else entirely. Greens perfectly seasoned, steak that is seared on the outside and pink within, potatoes overflowing with butter. Annie takes one look at her meal, then attacks it with her knife and fork as if determined to consume it before it disappears. It's been a long time since I've noticed how Annie approaches food. In the earliest years, she scarfed it, and I learned to imitate her. But in this context, a glittering dining room designed for laughter and leisure, it's hard to watch. As Duck begins to rave about his lunch, how it is the best meal ever, I slide a hand across the table and touch her wrist. "Slower," I murmur. She looks up from her plate. Her eyes widen and blink rapidly. She nods. It is one of the strangest meals I've ever had. I'm aware of how it tastes. Good. The way I remember expecting food to taste before I learnt to be grateful to eat at all. And I'm aware of Annie's eyes tracking me, determined to learn despite her flushed face. I become conscious of every habit of polite dining as I struggle to demonstrate them slowly, clearly, without comment, so Duck doesn't realize the lesson is taking place at all. Annie imitates how I pace myself, how I place a fork into the steak and a knife beside it to cut, how I don't let it grind against the plate, how I use the knife to guide peas onto my fork and place the utensils alongside one another when I've finished. The things you're taught to care about when you're not afraid of starving. By the end, I'm sick with shame. "And how was it?" says the serving girl, returning to ask if we'd like coffee or dessert. "It was the most amazing meal I've ever had," Duck says, so solemnly that she actually laughs. As we watch her take our plates back to the kitchen, his voice lowers. "Do you think she finds it strange being surrounded by people who..." Annie finishes his sentence immediately, like she'd been thinking about it too. "Who tested better than her? Or were born into the kind of privilege that made them test better," I mutter. Fresh off a meal spent demonstrating that privilege, the observation smarts particularly. Annie's eyes remain on the dregs of her cider as she tilts the glass back and forth. Her reply is mild but has a tone of finality to it. "I like to think that everyone had to get here on their own merits, no matter where they came from." I lift my eyes to her, willing her to acknowledge me in this reprieve by looking at me. But she only glances across the floor again. "In any case, most people are speaking Kalish. A lot of it's palace standard, but there are Southside accents at that table over there, and Harbour Town accents behind us." I hadn't noticed, focused as I had been on the sounds of my mother tongue. "Even if the dragon tongue representation is a little more than proportionate to the Kallipolan population," Annie adds grimly. "I hope my sister's metals test went all right," Duck mutters. Annie's hand slips over his on the table and squeezes it gently. She doesn't notice the way Duck goes still at her touch. Then her wandering gaze catches on someone across the room and her hand drops. I twist around in my seat. Power has noticed us, and he's beckoning Annie over to his and Darius's booth. Some of the girls from rhetoric class are giggling behind their hands, catching each other's eyes. "Don't do it, Annie," Duck says at once. Eyes on Power, Annie tilts her glass of cider back and drains it. She returns the empty glass to the table, rises, and makes her way across the floor. Duck watches her depart with a line between his eyes. "And she tells me to ignore him."
Annie.
In a month, Power and I will be facing each other in the air. But today, I approach his table in the Lyceum Club as if we're facing off already. When I stand in front of it, he spreads his arms and leans back, his gesture taking in the entirety of the smoke-filled wood-paneled room. "Welcome," he says grandly in dragon tongue, "to my domain." The girls sitting with Power look avidly between us, like they're getting a pre-tournament sampler for free. When I don't say anything, power adds in Kalish. I just said. I understood you.
Good for you.
Power turns to the table. Antigone, having beat my mate Darius here, Darius glowers at him, will be my opponent in the upcoming match. He switches to Dragon Tongue and lowers his voice conspiratorially. She's a very ambitious serf. Titters go around the table. One of the girls actually lets out a suppressed shriek, scandalized. Power turns back to me, his eyes glittering. Isn't that right, Annie? He asks in Kalish. I can practically hear those watching us hold their breath. I know how this scene is supposed to go. I've seen Chrissa stand Power down in front of others, smoothly dousing his ego with a few well-placed words. The delighted guffaws of those listening to see him burned. I know that's what the table's waiting for. But my mind draws a blank. You idiot. What did you think would happen if you came over here? You think just because you won a match you'd get better at this? Yeah, I tell him, bitterness filling my mouth both at my words' inadequacy and the fact that they're in Kalish. That's right. I turn on my heel and walk away. That taste of bitterness continues throughout the day. My rounds schedule has never been as extensive as Lee's or even Duck's, and this afternoon I have only a single session shadowing Ornby, an elderly researcher who's vetting old Dragon Tongue literature for the censorship committee. Together in his dusty office, we go over which texts should be banned, which should be translated for the general public, and which should be limited to gold consumption.
Feeling lenient, are we?
Ornby says as he reviews my choices.
I'd have banned the sympathetic portrait of a dragon lord entirely. You'd make it available to the general public.
Still prickly from my lunch in the Lyceum Club, I shrug and offer one of Ornby's favourite phrases back to him. It could help the people grow in sympathy. Ornby's blue eyes crinkle as he shakes his head.
The golds, maybe. But we can't complicate the narrative too much for the lower class metals, or they'll get confused. Might even start wanting dragon lords back. You're cleverer than most people, Annie. You've got to remember that. Maybe you can handle the nuance of this piece, but they wouldn't.
Usually, Ornby's mention of my cleverness, flattering and always slightly conspiratorial, is enough to stop me from questioning censorship practices. But today my thoughts go to Duck's father spouting propaganda about New Pythos, and I feel a twinge of unease. By the end of the day, I've lost the good mood left over from the tournament entirely. Afternoon training begin with Goran spending a good half hour on the Eyrie, praising Lee's, Kor's and Power's tournament performances, and not mentioning mine at all. It feels like evidence that life, far from changing since gaining the Fourth Order, is going to proceed with exactly the same frustrations as before. After dinner, in another resumption of routine, I help Rock through his aerial tactics homework in the Cloister Solarium before study hall, where guardians are getting a start on homework at shared tables and easy chairs. I'm more impatient than usual today, and it's setting us both on edge.
You've got to keep the third dimension in mind. It's not a field, Rock.
Rock's problem set is spread between us, a web of diagrams I'm correcting as I talk him through them. At the other end of the table, Chrissa sits doodling on her history reading, and Duck applies aloe to his burns, sleeves rolled up to his forearms. The fading sunlight glows on potted plants lining wall-sized windows and creeping along a glass ceiling, opened to let in the breeze. The solarium is the only part of the cloister set aside for recreation. Rock's hair is on end, his eyes bloodshot from squinting at my scribbles.
I get it in theory, all right. You're worse than Gorin sometimes.
You don't like how I explain things? Go find Lee.
I tried, Rock says. He was busy.
Lee's busy schedule is the last thing I want to hear about. I glare at Rock. He folds his arms and glares back. A voice behind us interrupts. Annie, there you are. I turn in my chair. The formidable iron-haired Mistress Mortmain, directress of the cloister, is on her way to our mailboxes. She hands me a memo that bears the ministry seal of the four-tiered city. Concentric rings of iron, bronze, silver, and gold. I'll just give you this personally, shall I? Her eye flickers in what might just be a wink before she moves on. The memo, addressed Attention Fourth Order Riders, contains a list of schedule changes for me, Lee, Power, and Core, effective immediately. The sight of my name next to the words Fourth Order sends a jolt down my spine. Begin attending. Advanced Dragon Tongue Poetry. Weekly High Council meetings, if not already attending. Advanced etiquette and dance lessons, to begin 2 weeks before Lycian Ball. Private class weekly with the First Protector. I feel a smile spreading of its own accord across my face. It's happening. Whatever Gorin or Power might say or not say, however scanty my round schedule might still be, the ship has pushed off from the shore, and I'm on it. I arrive at Dragon Tongue Poetry the next day a few minutes early. The classroom door is still shut. Of all the changes from the memo, this is the one I'm most certain I'll like, and do well in. Our study of languages of the Median has been purely conversational classes until now, but I've always been interested in Dragon Tongue Poetry, which is renowned for its beauty. The Dragonborn, and Aurelians particularly, whose language it was first, before they came to Callipolis, are known to have lived and breathed their poetry, speaking as often in quotations as not, and began learning it by heart as children. As far as the Inner Palace is concerned, knowledge of Dragon Tongue Poetry is a form of literacy patrician families of Callipolis still value, and will expect of its rulers. Lee is waiting outside the classroom too. Far from sharing my excitement, he's fuming. I don't believe this. Of all the ways to waste our time. There are circles under his eyes. Since his promotion to squadron leader, he often looks tired during the school week. Core appears at the end of the hallway, looking similarly sleep-deprived and similarly indignant.
Is this a joke? This is our reward for making Fourth Order.
Gold students have begun to arrive, giving us curious glances as they make their way inside the classroom. The Guardians are so outnumbered by Gold students at the Lyceum that our presence in new classes tends to be treated as a novelty. Neither Core nor Lee moves to follow them. They seem to be agreed on lingering in the hallway for as long as possible. It's a cultural literacy thing, I tell Core. Core lowers his voice, eyes tracking the arriving Gold students.
Maybe for you. I haven't got your knack for dragon tongue. I'll just be embarrassing myself in front of a bunch of patrician kids. Ah!
Power is sidling down the hall, already looking amused.
Such long faces.
Core scowls at him.
Piss off!
Power drops his bag with a thud between Lee and Core. Two passing gold girls glance our way, and Power rakes a hand over his close-cut hair, catching their eyes with a lifted eyebrow. They disappear into the classroom, giggling.
Word is, this class is pretty easy. If you've already got the Aurelian cycle memorized, that is.
Lee is leaning against the wall, arms folded. His lip curls. Didn't know you were such a dragon tongue scholar, Power. I had tutors. Lee tosses his head back and laughs. Then he smiles at Power. Good for you. The force of Lee's disdain makes Power flinch. He recovers with a startled shiver, gives Lee a strange look, and regains some of his confidence to share more Lyceum gossip. I've heard the class is taught by a former court tutor anyway. Got his start teaching Storm Scourge brats before the revolution. Guess he wasn't so loyal in the end. Kor snorts in spite of himself. Lee's smile hitches. For the instant before he fixes it, his whole body stills. As far as I can tell, I'm the only one who notices. We're going to be late, I tell them. Inside the classroom, the four of us take empty desks at the back. The only other guardian already enrolled in this class is Lotus, whom I recognize even before he turns and waves by his curly head of hair. His connection to Dragon Tongue poetry through his father probably means he's here by choice. The girl whose desk is next to mine leans in my direction.
Are you Antigone? Antigone Sir Ayla?
The way she says it, I feel like she's talking about someone neither of us has met. I nod, and she beams.
Your flying this weekend was amazing, she says.
I return her smile with surprise, and the girl extends her hand. Her brown dress, a muted color against her tawny complexion and spiraling black hair, shows the signs of a comfortable patrician life, cut to knee length with the precision of a janiculum dressmaker, and carefully pressed.
Hannah, she says. Hannah Lund. Though I guess there's no reason you'd want to know who I am.
I shake her hand, too startled to think of a polite way to disagree with such an unexpected remark.
Our new students, welcome.
The professor, a pale, balding, bespectacled man in his mid-30s, has entered the room last and notes our presence with a gracious smile as he takes his place at the front of the room.
My name is Richard Tyndale, and I am absolutely delighted to have the four of you in my class. Let's see.
He consults a list, then looks at me.
You must be Antigone Sir Ayla?